Welcome back to the FKT podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today I'm joined by Monica Monroe, who set the unsupported FKT for the 223-mile-long Ouachita Trail. She completed the trip in 6 days, 13 hours, and 19 minutes. Thank you, Monica, for coming on the show today. I'm looking forward to chatting with you about the Ouachita Trail.
Thanks for having me.
So we've had some people on before who've talked a little bit about trails in the region, but I'm wondering if you could just talk about the Ouachita Trail itself, where it starts, where it ends, what the trail's like. Just paint a picture for our listeners.
So the Ouachita Trail crosses into Oklahoma and Arkansas. Most people take it eastbound. So starting on the Oklahoma side, it's really rocky at the beginning for about the first 50 miles. And then you get to the state line and Queen Wilhelmina Lodge. And that's where a lot of people drop the trail. But you've got lots of ups and downs after that to go through still. And then it ends real close to Little Rock at Pinnacle Mountain State Park, going around Lake Maumelle, where it's on the elevation graph, it looks pretty flat. There's still some little hills and ups and downs, but it's pretty flat around the lake when you finish. So you start at Tallahena State Park in Oklahoma and finish at Pinnacle Mountain State Park in Arkansas.
When you set your FKT, though, you did not do it that way, correct?
No. So I've hiked the trail before a few times. I'd done a through hike 2.5 years previous, going the correct direction, the eastbound, like I said, the way that the trail markers are laid out. And I had read Nick Fowler's trail report from the previous fall, and he said he'd done that 15 times. And finally, when he went westbound, he was successful. I said, well, I can just go westbound then. That's why I just decided to go westbound.
I want to circle back on that a little bit later, but first I want to ask, so obviously you've done this trail before. So why did you want to set an FKT? And then I also noticed that you were the first women's unsupported time. And so I'd also like to know why you went unsupported, which, you know, is arguably harder than any other way to do it. So maybe you could just address that.
Well, so I had started out on this trail back in 2021, section hiking it as a novice backpacker. And the trail just has a really good community around it. So it's very, very accessible to a beginner backpacker. I had lots of help on the Facebook group, and there was, you know, an Excel spreadsheet where the water was. There's a far out map for it. So really accessible to get into it. And then after I had section hiked it, I did a through hike of it with my partner, and we were actually at a Arkansas Ultra Runners Society trail run preparing him for the Arkansas Traveler 100 mile race. And I ran into Stacy Shaver, who's part of the mixed gender unsupported FKT team. And she's the race director for the Arkansas Traveler. And I was talking to her about race directing. My partner and I have a backyard ultra, so I wanted to get some tips on race directing. And then I started getting into, well, tell me about your FKT. And she was talking about how she was nervous as a woman backpacking alone. And I thought, well, I've backpacked lots of sections of this trail alone. I've been out here at night by myself. And so that's one of the things that got me thinking about, well, maybe I could set the FKT on it. My partner had originally offered to do it with me and we could try to beat the mixed gender team. But he ended up getting a new job. And I said, well, that's okay. I'll just go set the women's unsupported by myself.
And what drew you to want to do the FKT in general? Was it just because you were talking to Stacy about her unsupported FKT? Or had you already kind of thought about wanting to go out and set an FKT on this?
I really hadn't. So I'm an ultra runner and I have a neighbor that lives like 8 miles. I'm out in this tiny town in Kansas and I've got a neighbor that's also an ultra runner. And my partner and I, we went to his house. We had an ice cream run. His name is Farrell, and he has a bunch of friends over that are ultra runners. And he's like, okay, we're going to run from my house to the Winfield Fairgrounds for the tractor show. And we're all going to get ice cream and then run home.
Okay.
And I was there at this run, just this friendly group run. I'm looking around and I'm seeing, okay, she's got a state record. She's got a state record. He's got an age group record for the state. They have an FKT. They have an FKT. And I'm looking around and I'm the only one without any sort of record. So I'm getting a little bit of a jealousy, self-consciousness, saying, oh, man, I'm the slowest person here. So that kind of stuck in my brain. That was in August. And then I ran into Stacy in September and I was like, maybe this is my opportunity.
Okay. So really it all came down to an ice cream run.
Yeah. I just wanted to run for ice cream.
Right.
And there's this really cool old steam powered ice cream machine from an old Dairy Queen dollar ice cream. It was a good run.
That sounds like it's worth it. So you're in Kansas then. So it's not exactly local to you. How far away are you from the Ouachita?
It's about 7 hours to Little Rock.
Okay.
From where I live, and 5.5 hours to the Atalahina State Park. But we have one trail in Kansas that you can backpack, and it's 15 miles.
Oh, wow.
I did use it to train, but you don't have a lot of backpacking opportunity in Kansas. So you've got to, this was really one of the closest things that was accessible to me.
Okay. Because that was going to be my very next question is, how do you train for a hilly FKT when you're in Kansas?
Well, we live by the Arkansas River, and we have a hill out by our house that kind of goes down towards the river. And so hill repeats just on the road outside the house. And I just upped my mileage. We've got another Camp Horizon area, which is also by the river, about 45 minutes away. So I'd go down to this camp and go hiking around their area, maybe about 8-9 miles every weekend. We've got a couple little smaller wooded areas so I could practice trail running and basically just increasing how much time on feet I had. And I'm a PE teacher, so I spend all day, every day up on my feet, you know, playing tag, doing Tabata, playing games with the kids. So I'm getting lots of time on feet. I'm hitting my 10,000 steps by, you know, noon every day, no problem. But I had to train adding in at least a 30-minute workout every day when I got home, even if it was a tough day, even if I'm exhausted, still I got to do a workout of some kind. So that's mostly how I trained. A lot of it was I had previously been training for a 100K that I did in December at a 24-hour race. And so I'd been doing a lot of running. I'd done a backyard ultra for 50 miles in October. So I had a lot of base fitness. And then it became the switch from running to more working on hiking and stairs and carrying a pack.
Yeah, I was wondering if you trained doing these workouts, if you were carrying weight, because obviously when you're going unsupported, pack weight is a factor.
Yes, and I got my pack weight down to 26 pounds, including my food. And when I was training, I had gotten my pack weight up to 35 pounds. So it felt great day one putting on that pack. I was like, oh, this is much easier than what I've been practicing. But of course, I had 41 miles to do on that first day.
26 pounds is really good for, you know, your pack for, you were out there for over 6 days. So that's, what were you carrying? What was in there for gear? I mean, I know the Ouachita has nice shelters. So did you skip out on using a tent? Did you stay in the shelters? What was your gear setup?
Yeah, I didn't carry a tent. I just had a bivy sack and I planned out stopping at shelters along the way. And they're wonderful shelters, three-sided wooden shelters. There's usually like a porch area or like a gravel bed that's got a little countertop kitchenette kind of thing, picnic tables, fire rings. I didn't get to spend much time in them, but that's where I slept most nights. I had a bivy sack in case I needed to cowboy camp somewhere. I could just crawl into that. But I have a really nice down quilt and I used a Z pad to sleep on. Even though I had a really lightweight air mattress, I didn't take it because I didn't want to spend the energy airing it up every night. So I just wanted to be able to throw my stuff down and get in my quilt, get in my bivy sack if it's windy or extra cold, and then go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
My food was 12.5 pounds for 7 days worth of food. And I really only carried 2,800 calories worth of food each day. And I was burning 5,100 calories. And I knew I would be hungry. I had planned on carrying less than I needed. And I had practiced that amount of food over on the Elk River Trail. That one trail in Kansas, I did a 30-mile day, slept in my car, did another 30-mile day, the following day. That's how I spent Valentine's weekend. Mm. Was doing out and backs with my pack and testing
Very
my food.
Very romantic.
Yeah.
Just you and Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm. Just testing my food situation, hiking in the rain, hiking in, you know, we've got the ups and downs, probably the most similar trail I could find to the Ouachita anywhere nearby.
What about lighting? I assume you had to move at night sometime. Did you just have a regular headlamp? What was your lighting situation?
Yeah, just a regular headlamp. I had about 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours at night, sometimes 3 hours at night that I needed to have my headlamp. And it was one of the things I figured out on my Shakedown hike over on the Elk River Trail was that I could not use my headlamp on bright. I had to keep it on low if I wanted it to last the amount of time I needed it to last.
Yeah, I usually end up carrying two headlamps because I've had a headlamp die on me. And so I always have, and I like to have one around my waist and one on my head. But yeah, you have to be very judicious with that battery life.
Yeah, I figured I've hiked the trail before. I've seen it, so I don't need extra light.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I also kind of feel like I don't necessarily want to know what's in the woods looking at me at night. I don't need it to be on super bright.
Well, I actually, during one of my night hikes, I ran into a spotted skunk. And it was
they're so cute.
It was the cutest thing. It was this little bitty kitten-shaped fluffy thing with polka dots. And it just jumped up into my headlamp right in front of me. And I was so lucky I didn't get sprayed, but I also had all the intrusive thoughts that were just like, go catch it. It scampered off and it was a fun experience because I'd never seen one in the wild before.
Yeah, I've never seen a spotted skunk before, but I mean, I run into skunks at night and it's always that thing of like, oh, you're so cute. And I'm like, okay, don't spray me, please. Yeah, I've done that with porcupines before. They just get on the trail and then they're just going down the trail in front of me. And I'm like, okay, I want to pass you, but you're in the trail. And they're just kind of probably going top porcupine speed, which is not that fast.
Yeah, I've run into one porcupine and it was huge and very slow and it just kind of hung out.
Yep. My next question was about water, and I didn't hear you mention about a water treatment, but I know water can be a huge concern on the Ouachita. So do you want to talk about what you did for water? Because obviously, unsupported, you weren't able to put out water caches. So did you have a good water year?
Well, we had, I think, 4 days of rain the week before I went out.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Yeah. So we had some rain the week before, so I felt good about that. And then we had a thunderstorm roll through while I was on trail on day two. So that helped. I have previously used a Sawyer squeeze, and I was trying out a platypus similar design, just screws into the top of a smart water bottle, and I really liked it. It actually worked better than the Sawyer. It squeezed faster. I could filter 1 liter of water with three squeezes. So I really liked that. I had two pretty dry sections that I had to get through. I normally would carry one water bottle and fill it up as needed on days. The Far Out app would tell me when there's stuff. And I've had experience with the trail, so I know, oh, well, that says there's nothing there. Or I've walked over Pashubi Creek before, and I've never seen water in Pashubi. And there was actually water in Pashubi this time. So there were places that I didn't trust the Far Out notes, and I was wrong. And there were times when I knew that there would be things that weren't on the map. But I had two sections that were pretty dry. I had a 24-mile section and a 20-mile section, and I carried 3 liters of water through those sections.
Yeah, that's pretty significant when you're doing an FKT to be carrying 3 liters of water at a time. I assume you tried to strategize so that you weren't also sleeping in those sections so you could just get through them, you know, versus having to carry extra water so that you have to make up for being stopped.
There's one part where it's hard to do that, and it's Brushy Creek area. The Brushy Creek trailhead has a day use area where you can get down to the river, and then you've got to go over a bridge, and it's very uphill after that. So I stopped up at the Brushy Creek shelter that night, and I still had 5 miles left the next day before, 5 or 10 the next day before I got to a water source. So that was definitely budgeting my water, thinking about, okay, I've got this much water to get to the shelter, and I've got this much water to get through the night, and this much water for the next morning.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something you have to think about and consider, for sure.
And then, yeah, cameling up anytime I had a water source, especially I had one unexpected water source during the 24-mile stretch that was dry. I ran into this little trickle coming out of the mountain, stop, filter, camel up, go ahead and refill things. And I think I still had 7 miles left after that. So I'd run into water about 7 miles early on that one.
That's nice. And you don't have to ration at that point. Because I imagine you're not carrying, if you're taking 3 liters, you're like, that's the bare minimum. So you're probably pretty thirsty by the time you get to the end of that stretch.
Yeah, the idea is I'm finished with my 3 liters and I'm starting to get thirsty at the end. But that was one of the things, is just learning to be okay with body signals that were uncomfortable, like being hungry, being thirsty, being sore, being tired. Just keep going.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of FKTs in general. So you mentioned a thunderstorm. Can you talk in general about the weather you experienced out there and any sort of impact it had on your hike?
So started out day one, perfect day for hiking, like maybe 40, 50 degrees. And the wind started picking up towards the end of the day. And it was blowing really hard by the time I rolled into the Brown Creek shelter that night. The funny thing was, since I was hiking over spring break, there was a lot of people out on the trail, more than I've normally seen. But I barge into every shelter and, you know, wake up and startle whoever's there, because I'm waking them up in the middle of the night. You know, everybody's going to bed at dark. And I come in at 11 o'clock on the first night. And there's a women's hiking group that's on, a lot of them are on their first backpacking trip. And so they want to talk up a storm when I get in and ask about what I'm doing. And it was getting really windy. And I think I told them, I said, I don't know how long the rain's going to hold off tomorrow. There's definitely a front that's going to move through. And they gave me an update on the weather forecast that they'd checked. And they said it was going to come through about 4. And that was pretty accurate. I was in an area with low reception the next day, and the trees were just shaking in the wind, and I'm getting alerts popping up on my phone, but I don't have enough reception to open the radar. I don't have enough reception to really open anything other than see that it's severe thunderstorm warning, tornado watch, tornado warning. And so I text my partner back home, Command Station Central, and I ask him, can you just text me? Should I stop at this shelter that's coming up in 3 miles, or do I pause there and resume after, you know, the storm passes, or can I just keep going? And you can't send me a picture of the radar. I can't open it. Just tell me stop, wait, or go. And he's like, I think you're in a good spot with where the thunderstorm is. If it's not hailing or anything on you, keep going. And so I kept going, and I had maybe 2 minutes of heavy rain, and then blue skies just popped up. It was a really thin line of thunderstorms that moved through. But with that came the cold front, and the next 2 days were super cold. Got down below freezing for 2 nights, and I hiked in my puffy. The day 3, I think I had to put my water filter inside my puffy while I hiked, because my water bottles were turning to slush. So I wasn't quite expecting that, but I had been out on this trail before over spring break and had to hike through snow. So I wasn't unprepared for it, but it was a little chilly hiking for a couple days. And then by the end, the last day on trail, it was 86 degrees, and I was surrounded by like controlled burns and forest fires. And that was my only day I really got dehydrated, was when it was 86 degrees.
Everybody talks about the severe weather alerts going off when they're on this trail. It seems to be the area where that just happens. So I'm not surprised that you also had that. But that would be very scary, I feel like, to be getting tornado alerts while you're out in the woods.
Yeah, and I was 2 or 3 miles from the next shelter. So I had to keep moving no matter what, mm-hmm. You know, even if it starts hailing and pouring on me, because there's nothing I can do except keep moving. And by the time I'd gotten to the trail marker for that shelter, I looked over and it wasn't right next to the trail. I think it was maybe 0.3 miles off trail to go to that shelter. And I looked up at the sky and I was starting to see patches of blue. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to keep going.
Yeah. How many people were you expecting versus how many people did you see? I get the impression this trail is not extremely crowded, but it's popular with the local hiking groups?
Yeah, most of the time when I'm out there, I would say there might be one other person in a shelter, or you might have a shelter to yourself. This trip was over spring break, and so I think I might have coincided with Little Rock's spring break. And there was only one night I had a shelter to myself. And most days I probably saw 4 to 6 people on the trail. Then, like I said, the first 50 miles, which was my last 50 miles, which is where everybody starts the trail, that was the busiest portion. It was hilarious. As soon as I got past Queen Wilhelmina Lodge, I saw 25 people. So lots of people maybe hiking around the lodge, but I encountered a lot of people that had started at the beginning of the trail.
25 is a lot to see all at once.
Yeah. And it was just like back to back to back. And I kind of got tired of telling people what I was doing. I'm like, I have been out here for 5, 6 days. I don't need to keep having this conversation with the next person and the next person. So it was surprising to go from like 4 to 6 people a day to 25 people all at once, back to back.
You also mentioned fires. So you had rain, you had tornadoes, you had fires. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So the fires, it was kind of funny. I think it was on day 3 or 4, I started noticing this plume of smoke and the sky is getting darker and gray the direction I'm walking. So I send my partner, Aaron, I send him a text again. I say, hey, I'm walking into what appears to be a fire. You want to check that out for me and just let me know if I should stop? And he's actually a firefighter. And so I knew he'd be able to figure out what was going on pretty easily. And he is wonderful. And he actually went through the whole National Forest phone tree system and got a hold of a ranger on the phone and made sure that they had a good system for clearing the trail for any controlled burns they were doing, and made sure that he knew how to look for where the fires would be for these controlled burns. And he also found NASA has satellite imaging where you can see where forest fires are if it's not a controlled burn. So he was able to check and see where trail closures might have been. And there actually was a trail closure on part of my route, but I had planned to stop 2 miles before that trail closure. And the trail had actually opened up that evening before I got to the shelter. But I had to hike through that controlled burn the next day. And everything was, I wouldn't say out. There was certainly some fires still going on around me. And it was really cool because I walked through at, 5, 6 a.m., and there's, so much wind and the embers are blowing and it looks like fireworks, and the hillside and the landscape is just all dotted with what looks like campfires, but they're just the remnants of the control burn. So it was really cool to walk through in the dark.
Yeah, that seems like it would look really neat, but also kind of, I'm surprised they open it when there's still things that are actively on fire and sparking back there. Were your shoes getting like melty?
No, the trail is pretty worn to be a dirt path. And when they set these controlled burns, it takes away all the leaves that are on that dirt path. So you've got just the dirt that's left. And the fires that were remaining looked kind of like campfires, but they were basically brush piles or logs that were still smoldering. So none of it was really on the trail. I think I had to step over one log that had fallen across the trail that was, maybe 6 inches high. It was pretty little that was still smoldering, but it definitely made it a little exciting for a morning.
Right. Yeah. So the fires you encountered were all controlled burns then? There weren't any actual wildfires, or were there some that were wildfires as well?
The last day there was one wildfire that was about 7 miles away from me. I was looking out at the landscape and I could see 4 fires, and one of them looked really big. I think we figured out that one was an uncontrolled fire. Okay. Or at least it wasn't part of the Forest Service controlled burn plan.
Right. So aside from weather challenges, did you have any other big challenges like injuries, or did you get sick, or was there any gear failures? Did anything else go wrong out there?
Well, my injury kind of goes back to 2022. I had been section hiking this trail, and I'd just gotten back from a section hike over spring break. And I was in, you know, at work, teaching PE, teaching jump rope, and I tore my ACL at work days after getting back from the trail. And so my knee had to have surgery, and it's something that has always been in the back of my mind, as I kind of have to baby this knee now. It's got a big June bug tattoo on it because it's the knee that bugs me. No, it's been great. I was able to get back on trail about a year later and finish section hiking it. And that was kind of one of the things that motivated me to do the initial through hike, was I wanted to kind of have this redemption story of I'd torn my ACL, I'd healed, I'd lost some weight from it. And then now I want to get back out there and do this trail again. So no, on this trip, I didn't encounter a lot of challenges or failures. It was really well planned. And I kept telling myself, just stick to the plan. A lot of times your brain tries to trick you. Oh, let's stop early today. We'll do those miles tomorrow. And it's, nope, I have a good plan. And we're gonna stick with the plan. And so as long as I kept doing that, it worked out.
Yeah. It's great when you have the plan and you're able to just execute that plan just perfectly. So aside from skunks, did you see any other interesting wildlife out there?
I had a rabbit that was like running at me.
Oh.
It kept darting back and forth at me on the trail. At one point, I kind of put my stick out to get it to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
So that was a weird little night critter that I found. Lots of deer on the trail. I have previously seen wild boar out there, which is
okay.
The scariest thing for me.
Yeah, definitely.
I've seen mama and piglets, and I was glad to not see them this time.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I've seen a sow and piglets once as well, and I was just like, now I'm just going to go somewhere else.
And I have seen bear evidence before, and I didn't see any this trip, but I hear the rumor has it that there's more bear activity in Arkansas these days in the last year or two, but I saw less evidence of it this trip.
Yeah. They were on spring break too.
Yeah.
So now that you've gone out and you've set this FKT, have you tried to reconvene an ice cream run so that now you have your street cred you can talk about with everybody else?
Well, I'm pretty sure Farrell's going to host the ice cream run again in August. So I'll be ready this time. It was funny because that ice cream run was right after my partner and I had hiked 400 miles of the Pacific Northwest Trail. And so I hadn't run in over a month, and we get home and, you know, neighbors like, come on down, we're doing an ice cream run, and it's a 22 mile run. And I'm like, man, that I haven't been running. I don't know. So I ended up only going to the ice cream and caught a ride back. I only did 11 miles. So I think this year I will definitely do the full 22.
Definitely.
But it's August in Kansas and it's hot.
It's a good thing you're getting ice cream.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It was really nice chatting with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks again, Monica, for coming on the show. You can read about her FKTs on the website fastestknowntime.com. You can also follow her adventures on Strava or on TikTok at Make Way for Mudcat.